Catastrophes and disasters. What can we do to protect ourselves from them when they strike? In a moment, Robert Muirwood joins us. We're going to talk about his work called The Cure for Catastrophe, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. We've got some incredible couple hours for you. The Cure for Catastrophe, how we can stop manufacturing natural disasters. Robert Muirwood holds degrees in natural sciences and a PhD in earth sciences from both Cambridge University. He works to enhance approaches to natural catastrophe modeling, identifying these models for new areas of risk, and explore expanded applications for catastrophe modeling. He is a global risk expert, and here he is on Coast to Coast. Robert, my pleasure to have you on the show.
And mine to be on your show, too.
My, these catastrophes don't stop. We just saw a few hurricanes sprinkling by the United States, Hawaii, and up the East Coast. And I guess we really can't predict them, can we?
Well, we may not be able to predict exactly which day they're going to arrive, but we know the catastrophes which are going to happen. I mean, we know the very large majority of them, and we shouldn't be surprised when an event happens. And you know, that's what this book is all about.
Now, you're in the United Kingdom. You really don't get hit with the kind of weather we get hit in the United States, do you?
We get extreme windstorms, which are up to sort of Cat 2 hurricane level occasionally, and we get a lot of floods here. It tends to rain, but we are on the edge of Europe, and only less than 2 weeks ago there was an earthquake in Italy. It wasn't a very big earthquake, but it hit some mountain villages.
Uh-huh, that's right.
It was completely expected. That particular earthquake had happened before, about 300 years ago. The record in Italy is extremely, extremely well known. And yet, you know, 300 people died. And actually, we've reached the point now where that is, I would say, unacceptable. It's as unacceptable as a 747 falling out of the air due to a lack of maintenance. We need to change our attitude about natural disasters and not sort of think of them as acts of God, but actually, the large majority of them are events which we expect sometime. We may not know exactly when.
We're talking here in the Los Angeles area, Robert, of a major quake hitting, and I'm not sure we're prepared for it. What do you hear out there?
I know you have every year, I think, the big shake to get people to understand what they need to do if they hear that the earthquake is actually happening to get under a table. So, I mean, I think there is quite a lot of preparedness, but actually, I mean, one of the challenges of catastrophes is we don't exactly know which event is going to happen next. We know there's a whole range of possible events around Southern California, and so we need to be prepared for a wide range of possibilities. What goes on in California is pretty good, but actually we still know there are buildings which are dangerous there, which action has yet to be taken to actually improve them, to retrofit them. So there's still much more we can do to anticipate. And as I say, it's no longer good enough just to be surprised by events when they happen. There's a lot we can do to prepare ourselves and reduce the consequences.
Robert, when you talk about catastrophes, exactly what are we talking about?
Well, what I've chosen to cover are I think, what are typically called sudden onset events. So I'm covering the hurricanes and the earthquakes and the floods and the volcanic eruptions. Mm-hmm. I'm not covering man-made events. I'm not covering big terrorism. I'm not also covering droughts, simply because they take a lot longer to manifest. That is another book on its own. So I'm covering the things which sort of surprise us, which happen fast, high impact. Those are the ones which we really can get on top of. There's so much more we can do to anticipate what can happen.
Have you looked at the Hurricane Katrina disaster that hit New Orleans?
Absolutely. I know I've done a lot of work on Katrina and actually why the city was unprepared for it, why so many people were left in the city when the evacuations happened. There are a whole lot of big mistakes which actually went on before Katrina, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers had built a big shipping canal in from the ocean through to the city. And in fact, the storm surge pushed ahead of the hurricane actually arrived up the shipping canal exactly as it had in Hurricane Betsy in 1965, 40 years before. So you know, that's a very good example of how we manufacture natural disasters. They're not, you know, we can no longer call them simply natural. They are a large majority of actually what happens is by our own designs, by our own actions, how we manufacture the consequences.
Who is culpable for the failure of Katrina?
Well, I mean, there were lots of lessons to be learned. I mean, I think the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers acknowledged their responsibility. I mean, and the fact that the flood walls actually fell over before they were over top, the fact that the shipping canal, which, you know, it seemed like a good idea in terms of making trade more efficient, but actually it provided the conduit as to how the storm surge actually came into the city itself. You know, there wasn't enough money for flood defenses. After Hurricane Betsy in 1965, there had been moves to improve the flood walls around the city, but then the money ran out. I mean, the story is often the same, that in the immediate aftermath of a disaster, people will spend money on taking action to reduce the consequences. But 5 years on, they kind of, you know, it's faded a bit. They can't see why it's worth spending the money on building a flood wall rather than building new schools. And in a sense, the next disaster is already being prepared at that time. And we see so often that you know, the future disasters are already being cooked, if you like. They're gradually forming as a result of the neglect that follows the previous one.
We're with Robert Muirwood. His book is called The Cure for Catastrophe. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. It is rms.com, and it's very simple to get to. What is disaster anthropologists?
Well, I mean, I explore, at the end of this book, I sort of think through, for the new century, what do we need to do to actually, completely get on top of this problem? And I identify what I consider some new professions which we require. I mean, one challenge we have is we are very, very good at actually taking action once the catastrophe has happened. But I mean, by then it's kind of too late. I mean, you know, after Katrina, $14 billion was spent on building much better flood defenses around New Orleans. But it took having the catastrophe before that people were prepared to make that investment. And actually, that is kind of ridiculous that, you know, until Hurricane Sandy happens, until the yep. Northridge earthquake happens, we don't take the action. We have to wait for the event to occur. And in the future, we need to get a lot smarter about helping people anticipate the things which are going to happen before they happen, not wait for them to happen. And actually, one area, I mean, I just focus on is actually, well, how do we convince people of the need to do that? How do we bring them the stories they require so they get the importance of taking action? I mean, if you've just had the big catastrophe, no one needs to tell you it can happen. It's already happened. But actually, how do we do that? I mean, I take the example of the island of Barbados in the West Indies, in the Caribbean. They haven't had a big disaster there for a very, very long time. They haven't had either, and we know they get Cat 5 hurricanes. We know they get really big earthquakes from time to time, but they simply haven't seen anything, and so they kind of got complacent. I mean, it's typical of many places around the world where we know the risk is actually really high, but it's very hard to convince people, and so the idea of the disaster anthropologist is someone who can get under the skin of the culture of some location and really get people to understand the reality of what can happen, and then get them, therefore, to invest in taking action to prevent the worst consequences.
You know, based on what you've been saying, Robert, one of our major projects is to try to get our power grid insulated against either a large solar flare from the sun or an EMP attack, a detonation of a nuke in the atmosphere, which would render the power system useless. We've got to protect it, and they say for $2 billion, you can. It's going to cost 100 times that if something happens.
Absolutely. That's a very good example. We haven't seen one of these. We haven't really seen a big one of these of these solar storm events impacting power grids. We've seen some impact in Sweden in the past and in Canada, but actually we haven't seen a really big event in the US. So people may not see the wisdom of actually why you need to invest in something which hasn't actually happened. But we need to, so you know, the solution to this is to make the story of what would happen of, you know, having power outages running for months in some sections of the US, making that so tangible and real that actually people recognize they absolutely need to take action. And a number of countries have taken action now. Canada has taken actions. The Scandinavian countries have taken a lot of action. And there is action going on in the US on this, but it's probably not going on fast enough to really ensure that actually such an event can't happen.
These disasters, when they occur, come quickly and generally unexpected, right?
Well, I mean, so some you see coming. I mean, you know, you have the hurricane, we may have a few days
to prepare.
The warning. Right. I mean, different disasters have different warning times, and it comes right down to, you know, as a tsunami from a big earthquake, we may have 20 minutes warning. A tornado, you may have 5 minutes warning. I mean, every disaster type has some level of warning, except the earthquake. And that's what is so extraordinary, that you know, we still have not mastered the ability to anticipate when the earthquake is coming. However, there's a lot of ingenuity has been thrown at the problem. Now, in Japan, they have recorders, seismic recorders on the seafloor, because the biggest earthquakes of all tend to happen offshore. And they then take that information and actually, you know, the speed of electricity, they send it inland, and the earthquake waves are only coming at a few miles per second, in fact. So you can get a warning of 30 or 40 seconds in anticipation that an earthquake is actually rolling towards you. And that is being rolled out in other parts of the world now. It's being promoted, and it may actually come to fruition in California. I mean, the challenge in California is that the big earthquakes typically are not offshore, they're on land, and therefore you haven't got this natural lead time of the strongest shaking actually being in the place where you can give people 10 or 30 seconds anticipation. So that's a little bit of a challenge. It may still be worthwhile in California anyway, because if you had a big earthquake outside Los Angeles to the east, then you know, if you had 10 or 20 seconds warning, there are a number of things you can do. You can switch off dangerous machinery. You can shut down the electricity supply. You can actually take refuge yourself, maybe get under a table or a bed or something. So there's things to be done there, even though we are not really predicting actually what is coming towards us.
Though this is not a natural disaster, Robert, several years ago, a Southwest plane overflew its runway in Burbank at the Burbank Airport and was headed directly toward gasoline station pumps. And the young guy who was working was smart enough, he shut the pumps off because, you know, had the plane hit those pumps, everything would have blown up, the plane, the passengers, everything. And he was smart enough to do that. It's an example of preventative efforts to avoid a catastrophe.
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of catastrophes have what we call a cascade of consequences, which means that you start with one thing and it leads to another, and it can lead to another, and so on. I mean, you know, we saw that in Katrina. Started off as a hurricane, became a flood event, and then the flood event caused oil tanks to lift off, caused huge amounts of pollution to occur. So in the San Francisco earthquake in 1906, that started a whole lot of fires. It was the fires that burnt down the city. So the secondary consequences of an event can easily be bigger than the primary cause, we say. And clearly in that there is the power to take some action. I mean, there's a lot of work going on to try and identify what can be done to stop the fires which will inevitably follow a really big earthquake, and which could easily lead to more consequences than the shaking from the earthquake itself.
Oh, absolutely. Now, do you look at asteroids? Because those are catastrophes, too.
They are indeed. Yeah, I mean, we have looked at asteroids. I mean, there's obviously less you can do about asteroids unless you can really go science fiction and actually fly a mission to one. But, I mean, the... we know what can happen. I mean, they're extremely rare. They're more or less random where they could hit. Clearly, their consequences would be absolutely terrifying if they were to hit a major city. That's you know, it's maybe only once or twice a century we get an event big enough to actually come all the way down to Earth as a single solid object moving at thousands of miles an hour. So it's not one we typically worry about as much as the much more common events like the earthquakes and the hurricanes. I mean, those are the ones which I think we should probably focus on. There's much more we can do. There's much more we can anticipate, and they are going to be the events which turn up every year or so, and not every thousand years or so.
Robert, 1993 in the St. Louis, Missouri area, where I am right now, we had what was called a 500-year flood. It broke the levees. It was a mess, just a disaster. And they put new levees and everything else. And what they mean by a 500-year flood is it should occur once every 500 years. The problem is the minute it hits, that marks the end of that flood year. It could happen again next year.
It could indeed, yeah. So this, I mean, when we talk about things like the 100-year earthquake, the 500-year flood, it is rather confusing. And actually, there's a lot of people think we shouldn't use that kind of language because it convinces people that actually you've had one in 100 years, therefore you won't get another one for the next 100 years. I mean, what we should talk about really, it's a little bit technical. We should talk about what is the chance of it happening in a given year, and so. So a 100-year flood means there's a 1% or 1 in 100 chance that it happens in a given year, and it can happen. It can, you know, there can be a 1 in 100 chance it happens again in the following year. So it's a way of trying to communicate how likely events are. It's always a little bit worrying when anybody says something is a 500-year return period or 1 in 500. I get a little worried because actually the data they're using to tell you that may only last sort of 50 or 60 or maybe 100 years. So actually it's kind of off the end of your projection, and you're almost certainly setting yourself up for a fall. We had a situation in the UK where a flood happened in 2005 in a city called Carlisle on the Scottish-England border, and the government then went around building flood defences against this, having told everybody it was a 200-year event or something, and then the flood happened again and actually went straight over the flood defences, and everybody is now left rather confused about this. I mean, one feature which makes this particularly complicated is that many classes of catastrophe, if you have one, you can be more likely to have another one. If you have a big flood and the ground is saturated, you're much more likely to get another flood a week or a month or 2 or 3 months later. If you have a big earthquake, you're more likely to get follow-on earthquakes after it. If you have a big hurricane, you can have situations where you get multiple hurricanes forming at the same time. So a lot of things are not completely independent or not completely random in how they happen.
Structurally, are we prepared for major earthquakes and things like that in this country, in the United States?
It varies from location to location. As I say, the main the main feature we find is that if you have had an event, then money starts getting spent on actually taking precautions against it. So we had the Loma Prieta earthquake in Northern California in 1989, and a lot of money was then spent on improving bridges. The Bay Bridge got rebuilt, or a section of it got rebuilt, in improving overpasses. So a lot of money actually went in based on what was seen in that earthquake. And that earthquake was not it was up in the Santa Cruz Mountains, really. It was actually quite a long way away from some of the places where it did the most damage. But so action was taken there. I mean, action was taken in Los Angeles after the Northridge earthquake in 1994. So action has got taken. I'd say, it's sort of mark California, especially where the biggest earthquakes are expected, as it's doing is making progress. I mean, the big challenge in the U.S. is the Cascadia region, so Northern California.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about that, Robert. We're at a break. We'll come right back. The cure for catastrophe. And welcome back, Robert Muirwood with us, his work, The Cure for Catastrophe. Robert, you're a global risk expert. Exactly what is that?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure who gave me that title, but I mean, I work for a company called Risk Management Solutions, which is the largest risk modeling company worldwide, has more than 1,000 people who are involved in actually in trying to build simulation models of catastrophes, of both natural and man-made catastrophes, and these are then very, very widely used by the insurance and reinsurance industry for actually how to price risk, how to manage risk, and increasingly they're being used by governments and cities that are also trying to work out how they need to get on top of the problem of catastrophes, because we never know exactly which event is going to happen next, and there's a whole wide variety of events could happen, and the smaller ones are more likely than the big ones, but we need to be thinking about the big ones too. And the problem exists all around the world. I mean, the reason that the global is useful is that big earthquakes are really quite rare in any one area. I mean, you can wait a long time for a big earthquake to turn up, but actually, if you're looking worldwide, the experience of the latest earthquake in Italy or Japan or New Zealand can be really useful. I mean, the lessons that you pick up in one part of the world can be applied in another part of the world. So it is a kind of a global business to actually try and get on top of and see if we can do the best at reducing the consequences of disasters wherever they occur.
Robert, tell us about your concern about Cascadia on the West Coast near Washington and Oregon.
Okay, so if you are concerned with the big one in the U.S., the big one beyond California, it is definitely the Cascadia earthquake which you'd be focusing on. I mean, there was a period in the 70s and 80s where people assumed that actually maybe, even though we knew there was a plate boundary along the coast of Northern California, Oregon, Washington, and Vancouver Island, with the characteristic volcanoes running along inland, people initially assumed that it simply didn't have big earthquakes. But then the evidence started mounting. There were if you go along that coast, you find strange areas where the forest. There's dead trees actually rising up out of land, which is now below the level of high tide. It was actually discovered from actually looking at the tree rings. In fact, exactly when this had happened, it happened in the year 1700, and then they found that actually in Japan there were records of what they called a ghost tsunami, which is a large tsunami came into Japan, and actually, but there was no earthquake, and they eventually traced it back as to that was the tsunami, which was actually launched by a massive earthquake, a monster magnitude 9 earthquake along the Cascadia coast. So now we recognize such earthquakes can happen. Clearly, they haven't happened for the last 200 years, and the question is, how often can we expect that earthquake to come around again? And it seems, on average, if we look back at past records, it comes around again every 400 years or so. So we haven't quite got to 400 years since the last one, but these things are not like clockwork. So it could happen again now. It's more likely to happen again in perhaps 50 or 100 years. But Cascadia earthquake, I mean, magnitude 9 is at the top end of the size of earthquakes. It would have extraordinary consequences, both for the shaking impacts and the tsunami, which will impact the whole of that coastline. It'll affect inland cities like Portland and Seattle with very slow, long-lasting ground shaking. It will be quite similar to the earthquake which hit Japan in 2011 or Chile in 2010. So if you sort of look and think back at all the things that happened in that, all the tsunami impacts, all the shaking impacts, that's what one can expect. There's a FEMA study of a Cascadia earthquake, which is forecasted that 13,000 people will die in Oregon, California, and Washington State. So it's an extraordinary number if you compare that with how many did die in the Loma Prieta or Northridge earthquakes. And we are talking about a few tens of people killed. So that gives some sense of the magnitude of what the impact would be. We know that the power would be out for a long period in coastal areas, that there would be a lot of towns and villages cut off due to landslides, due to collapsed bridges. I mean, it would be a really terrible catastrophe impacting that area, having long-term implications for months and years afterwards.
Generally, what kills people in an earthquake? Is it the falling buildings, the heavy concrete? What does it?
Yeah, I mean, most of the time, I mean, the seismologists, the people who study earthquakes, like to say it's not the earthquakes that kill you; it's the buildings. If you're standing out in the open and you get the strongest shaking of all, unless there's a boulder which is going to roll down a hill on top of you, then that's not going to do you any harm. It's actually being inside a building which wasn't designed for that level of shaking and collapses. A building can take some damage, you're still okay. If the building collapses, then that's the point where actually you get fatalities. So we need to really focus on doing everything possible to prevent buildings collapsing. But that requires following the codes, having an engineer, doing the best job you can. And there's a huge legacy of buildings which have been built without engineers. Before building codes, I mean, especially outside the U.S. in poorer countries, cement became widely available through the last 50 years, and any builder thought they could build any kind of building out of concrete. And actually, these are often the most dangerous buildings of all, buildings built without an engineer in sight.
Did Castro come up with anything innovative to protect Cuba from hurricanes?
Well, I mean, this is a story I tell in this book, is sort of looking to see the way in which disasters get quite political. And I mean, it's sort of interesting story in Cuba that when Castro took over in 62, 63, one of the first things that happened to him was he was hit by this big hurricane which came and sat over the island, a hurricane called Flora, and it dumped huge amounts of rain, and I think in several feet of rain fell over the space of two or three days, and there were huge floods, and almost 2,000 people were killed. And he saw what had happened, and sort of he realized that actually in order to prove that actually communism could actually benefit his people, then actually maybe he should set out to try and save lives in hurricanes. So he set up a system, which is still running today, where they do everything possible to take action. If a hurricane is forecast, they may move whole towns. All the people in the towns may be moved inland two or three days in advance. They switch off the electricity before the hurricane has even made landfall. They pick all the crops. The army picks the crops because they don't belong to anybody in Cuba, so the army can pick them. And so they do everything possible to reduce the casualties in hurricanes. And they actually do a pretty good job. I mean, they have to coerce a lot of people to take all these actions. But the one thing they don't do is they don't really help people's property, because the economy isn't strong enough to actually fund building proper buildings. And so you have situations in Cuba where if people know a hurricane is coming, they'll unfasten the fastenings on their roof to try and hope that it blows away, because that's the only way they'll get a new roof, is if their roof blows away. And there is no insurance, so they have to kind of play tricks on the system to try and see if they can do well out of it. Even though the casualties from hurricanes in Cuba are actually some of the lowest for such an area of any country which is impacted by tropical cyclones worldwide.
Should his program be duplicated elsewhere?
Well, I mean, I think there may be a few things you could learn from it, but it's simply, I mean, in a free society, you could say, I mean, you have to give up some of those freedoms in order to play things like that way. I mean, if you imagine, you know, you have the town of Miami, and you're telling people you need to evacuate. Well, you have to evacuate. There's no choice. I mean, you're going to be put onto a bus and 2 or 3 days ahead of a hurricane making landfall, and it may not make landfall at all. I mean, maybe the hurricane will miss you, but that's just too bad. The whole economy will come to a stop for several days. I mean, there are lots of consequences of this kind of attitude, which simply won't work in a free society. So I wouldn't, you know, there may be a few things which one could learn, but I don't think you could import that system. People simply wouldn't go along with that.
I'll always remember as a kid the little Dutch boy with his thumb in the dike keeping it from exploding with water. What do the Dutch do to stop from flooding?
Well, if you're looking around, I mean, one thing I do in this book is look around the world to see who we can learn from. And actually, you know, I would say the people who really have demonstrated talent and expertise at getting on top of their disasters were the Dutch. They did this 400 or 500 years ago. I mean, this was a huge threat to them. I mean, the country which is now the Netherlands, where the Dutch live. I mean, originally it was a swamp. I mean, it was a swamp, a sort of unmanageable swamp. And then they got the idea of actually cutting drainage ditches through the swamp and actually draining the land. And actually, then it was very fertile for growing crops on. But as they did that, the land was sinking, and as it started sinking, it started being hit by floods. So either floods coming in from the sea, or floods from the rivers, or floods from extreme rainfall. And they had to devise the most sophisticated way of actually handling this problem, or they would have lost the whole country. I mean, they came quite close to losing huge areas of land in their history. But they cultivated both institutions. So they created institutions that actually started managing floods on a large scale. They started getting all the villages to cooperate, and they got everybody in Holland to recognize that this is everybody's problem. This is not just one you lead to a few experts. Every villager had a responsibility for looking after the embankment that protected them. It became everybody's job. So, I mean, it was the perfect example where you have the institutions and you have the culture. You have everybody thinks it's their problem. You get those working in tandem, and they beat floods. I mean, by the end of the 17th century, so this is 300 years ago, they had mastered how to handle floods, and they became the richest country in Europe soon after, on the back of the fact that, you know, they had all this new land they'd got hold of, they'd reclaimed, they were growing lots of crops, they could feed lots of people, they had these canals built. They were the masters. And actually, you know, it's a really good story to look at, I think, to think through, well, how could other countries, even today, absorb some of those lessons for how you manage your disasters, even other kinds of disasters beyond flooding, where, you know, we are seeing a lot of progress in some countries, but I always encourage people to go and actually read about how the Dutch handled this.
You've got a great story about a 10-year-old English girl who inspired a Japanese professor. What happened?
I have, yeah. I mean, this is also a very positive story. I mean, clearly, if you look at disasters, you've got the sort of the stories of the mistakes, and you find all too many of them, and then you find the successes. So the story of a little English girl called Tilly Smith, who was 10 years old and was on holiday in Thailand on the beach on the day after Christmas in 2004, and 2 weeks before, she in a class at her school back in England, she'd been taught by her geography teacher that if you ever are on a beach and the water starts receding away, so there's the water level starts to fall, then a tsunami is coming, because often the first thing that happens is the water goes out and then it comes back as a much, much higher level, as a great big wave. And so she screamed, this little girl screamed at all the people on the beach around her and told them to leave the beach immediately. And she didn't ask permission to do that. She didn't check with her mum and dad first. She just actually did it. And everybody was sort of so motivated by this incredibly self-confident little girl that they all got off the beach. And it's estimated she saved about 100 people on that beach. It was the only section of beach where nobody died when the tsunami came in. And a Japanese professor called Katada, who was actually studying how people respond to information in the middle of a disaster. Mm-hmm. Because often what people do is they look around them and discover, are other people panicking or not? And if they see other people are not panicking, they assume it's okay. And then the tsunami comes and hits them. So he was inspired by this little girl. So he went back to Japan and he picked a town on the north coast or the north east coast of the main island of Japan, which he knew was right in the tsunami front line. He got permission to actually go and run a course in each of the schools in this city and teach people the idea they should be self-motivated, they should take initiative themselves, they shouldn't wait around to be told what to do. And he taught this for 2 or 3 years, and then the great earthquake and tsunami of 2011 happened, and in fact all the children in this city, all the children who were at school that day, and there were hundreds of them, all of them survived because they followed his lesson. They started running up the hill, and inspired by each other, they didn't wait for anybody to tell them what to do. They just did it, and they got a little the small children at the primary school. They got them to run with them, and they looked after them as they went up the hill, and every child who was at school that day survived. And in the city where he'd done this teaching, more than 1,000 people drowned who didn't take the action, who weren't part of his teaching program. So it's a great story about the inspiration of a 10-year-old and actually how that saved the lives of many children in this city.
Robert, have you looked at volcanoes and the possibility of damage they can do?
this is the job of being a risk expert is all these things get thrown at once. So I've looked at volcanoes. So volcanic eruptions, again, are kind of rare, very rare for any one volcano, and overall pretty rare. The last really big damaging volcanic eruption that has happened worldwide. We have to go back to a volcano in the Philippines called Pinatubo back in, I think it was 91 or 92. Uh-huh. So it's a long time ago since we had a really big eruption.
Big one's coming?
Well, a big one, I can certainly guarantee a big one is coming, but I don't know where and I don't know when. We can certainly pinpoint certain volcanoes which an eruption would be very challenging. In the U.S., Mount Rainier in Washington State.
How about the Yellowstone caldera?
Sorry? The
Yellowstone caldera.
Yeah, the Yellowstone caldera is what is called a super volcano, where that's a huge crater with an enormous chamber full of magma underneath. The only good thing to be said about Yellowstone is that if you were trying to park a dangerous volcano in the U.S. in a place where it could do the least harm, that's pretty much where you'd locate it, because there are. It's not in such a populated area as, for example, Rainier. Rainier will not be a super eruption, but it's got a big ice sheet sitting on top of it, which is going to melt and cause a lot of flooding problems in the valleys around it.
Robert, we're at the top of the hour. We will be back to talk about the cure for catastrophe. We'll take phone calls, questions, and stories. If you've been in a catastrophe, such as the ones we've been talking about, share those stories from New Orleans to Washington, wherever you may be.